most important thing is to take a stand and protect the unborn and protect life in the state of Oklahoma. We believe every life is precious. As a father of six, those are my core beliefs. And I'm elected by all 4 million Oklahomans to represent them and to put our beliefs into law.
Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt signing anti-abortion legislation last month. That law would criminalize performing the procedure and make it a felony, and that goes into effect in August. More recently, Stitt signed a separate law modeled after Texas's restriction that bans abortion after 6 weeks and allows private citizens to enforce it through lawsuits. That law is now in effect. In the fall, right after the Texas law went into effect, I spoke with an OBGYN from Northern California who'd been traveling to Oklahoma. She went there to help relieve overburdened OBGYNs there who were seeing a lot more patients from Texas. And we're going to check back in with her now. Dr. Rebecca Taub, welcome back to Press Play.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you back. So what do these laws mean for the Oklahoma City Clinic you've been working in?
Yeah, so they are quite impactful for our clinic, obviously. Currently, with the 1503 bill that was just passed, which was modeled after Texas's SB 8, as you mentioned, I mean, our operations are pretty severely curtailed, and we are sort of figuring out how to move forward. The clinic that I go to in Oklahoma also has a clinic site in Kansas, and so we are directing most of our patients to that Kansas clinic and really figuring out how to optimize our operations and really, you know, be able to see as many patients as possible there, recognizing that the patients from Texas who are coming to Oklahoma, and now the patients from Texas and Oklahoma, you know, will all be coming to Kansas, and that's really going to affect Kansans' access as well.
So now you're working in a Kansas clinic in Wichita, and how many patients are you seeing now?
So in Kansas, we are currently seeing, we have about 40 to 50 patients on the schedule a day, I would say. And, you know, we see whoever comes of that number. So generally, for, you know, various reasons, our no-show rate can be high. But we're seeing, I would say, between 25 and 35 patients a day regularly.
And how many doctors?
One doctor.
One?
Yes.
Just you?
Just me. Yep.
So if you were working a 10-hour day nonstop, that would be three patients an hour.
Right. Yes.
You must be exhausted at the end of your stint there.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, they're long days and we are very busy when we are there. It's definitely, it's knowing that you're providing care to people who, you know, really need it and now more than ever otherwise wouldn't be able to access that care that really keeps you going.
Well, you're saying that this will affect the number of Kansans who will be able to seek abortion care because of all the patients coming from Texas and Oklahoma.
Yeah, absolutely. So even before Oklahoma passed their most recent bill, when Texas SB 8 went into effect, about two-thirds of the patients that we were seeing in Oklahoma and half of the patients that we were seeing in Kansas were coming from Texas. So already that's half the appointments that aren't available for people from Kansas who, you know, need appointments. And so now we're seeing, you know, people from both Texas and Oklahoma having to go to largely Kansas. There are, you know, other states that people are going to, but Kansas is really absorbing a lot of that need. And so as we see more states likely passing restrictions like this, and, you know, obviously depending what happens in the Supreme Court, potential widespread restrictions, we're going to see sort of this ripple effect of people getting pushed out farther and farther for appointments, not just people who are living in more restrictive states, but even people who are living in states with better access are going to have more difficulty accessing this care because of everyone needing to cross state lines to get their appointments.
Wow. And what is the situation in Kansas? That's also a conservative state. Are they also moving to put in more restrictions or even outlaw abortion there?
So the right to abortion is currently constitutionally protected in the state of Kansas. There is an active effort to overturn that decision. And if that was successful, then certainly they would move to pass a restrictive ban, you know, quickly after that. But right now we are still hoping to be able to defeat the bill that is looking to overturn that constitutional protection. So we are hopeful for the future of abortion care in the state of Kansas. And if any Kansans are listening, I really encourage you to get out and vote in your primary.
What kinds of conversations have you been having with your patients these days?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very unfortunate situation. And, you know, when patients come, even when they come from Texas and Oklahoma, there's often sort of a varying level of, you know, just people's awareness of everything that's happening often in their home state and certainly nationwide. And so, you know, people are there for the care and I don't engage them in, you know, sort of political conversation unless it comes up. But, you know, certainly a lot of people ask us about it and we just try to, you know, reassure them that we'll be here and, you know, seeing people for as long as we can.
Are there more doctors from places like California interested in traveling to these states like you?
Yeah, I think that's been one of the, you know, if there is any silver lining to everything that has been happening, it has really been the outpouring of support from not only the abortion and family planning community, but the broader OBGYN and family medicine community and all of our pro-choice allies. Definitely, there are several doctors who I know started traveling kind of since everything has been happening in Texas. And people are certainly feeling the urgency of this moment and are feeling motivated to provide help in whatever way they can. And that has been really wonderful and reassuring.
I'm also curious how all of this has affected you and other doctors you know who perform abortions when you have a law about to go into effect in Oklahoma that criminalizes abortions, making it a felony with a punishment of a $100,000 fine or up to 10 years in prison. How does that sit with you as a doctor? And does it make you fearful in any way? I know you're not practicing abortions in Oklahoma right now, but there is a whole tenor in the air, I guess.
Yes, definitely.
And I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, it is extremely disheartening to say the least. And, you know, it definitely does make us concerned, you know, for our safety. And, you know, we already know that there are people who wish harm upon abortion providers. The clinic that I go to in Kansas was started by a physician, Dr. Tiller, who was murdered by anti-abortion extremists in his church in Wichita. And so we take security very seriously. And it's definitely at the top of our minds. And as these restrictions continue to get passed, we really are concerned not only about our own safety, but about the safety of the staff and people who support the clinic who live in that community. You know, I'm only there a week a month, but, you know, they live there full time. And then really about the safety of our patients and about the potential criminalization of our patients and criminalization of pregnant people who need help.
Hmm. Well, I hope you stay safe and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Rebecca Taub. She's an OBGYN from the East Bay, and she travels to Kansas once a month to help patients who need abortions. Future OBGYNs are also worried about the possible fall of Roe v. Wade. Learning how to perform abortions is an essential part of medical training for future OBGYNs. But nearly half of all residency programs, OBGYN residency programs in the United States, are in states that could ban abortions if Roe falls. And so that means if states outlaw the procedure, it would no longer be taught in those states. We're going to talk about this now with Dr. David Turok. He's an OBGYN in Salt Lake City, Utah, and that's one of the states that's ready to ban nearly all abortions, with exceptions only for rape, incest, or saving the life of the mother. And Dr. Turok is one of the few doctors who performs abortions in Utah and teaches medical residents how to perform them. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. So Utah has one of these trigger laws ready to go into effect. What does that mean for you, and what does it mean for how you do your job, both as a doctor and as a teacher?
It means that we've spent the last few months anticipating this and you know, for trying to figure out every possible angle to, number one, provide care for people who will need it, who have needed it in the past and will continue to need it, because abortion is not going away. You cannot legislate it away. You know, and of course, a priority is also maintaining the skills of people that we train and making sure that the next generation of providers is able to do this as well.
But how would you do that if it's pretty much illegal, except in those few instances?
Right. So, you know, as far as residency training goes, this is going to be a real challenge. There is no doubt about it. But travel is one answer. And the nature
of hang on. What do you mean by travel? But you mean by training people in, let's say, Colorado, which allows abortions?
So there, you know, relationships exist between academic medical centers, and it will be a serious stressor for those, for the states where it is legal. But yeah, there will be efforts made, and you know, people will be traveling, you know, to get this kind of critical experience. Like right now, for example, you know, I'm in a clinic where we had a resident who traveled from the Midwest because in her program, she can't get the training, you know, that she needs in order to do her job when she's done. So she sought it out and worked on it for a year to make it happen.
Well, it's interesting because we just talked to Dr. Rebecca Taub about how stretched she and the other doctors are in this Kansas clinic in Wichita, where she now works. Would you think of maybe sending some residents to a place like that where they're seeing an influx of patients from other states?
I mean, that seems like a natural alignment.
Right. But you won't be doing that in Utah.
We will not be able to continue that kind of training in Utah. I mean, there are other things, right? Like there are programs that are minimally getting by and meeting the, you know, necessary national requirements to train residents, and they're doing it by caring for, you know, people with miscarriages and abnormal pregnancies. That's a second rate approach. Mm-hmm. You know, for the 20 years that I have worked at, you know, in a university program, we have had dedicated time where residents learned how to do top quality abortion care. And, you know, one of the impacts of this will be in these states that, you know, have restrictions and have restrictions on training, they will get lesser quality applicants and lesser quality faculty. So one of the things that I have seen over the couple of decades that I've been doing this kind of teaching is residents in the past, we had, you know, a greater proportion of residents opt out, maybe half, and now that's less than a quarter opt out of abortion training. And that's fine. What we're seeing now, though, is nearly almost all of the residents are all in. They want the training. And that's been going on for, I would say, you know, more than 5 years now.
Why has that changed?
I think there's a growing consciousness and sense of need among the young people who are getting trained now. And, you know, people coming out of medical school, the best applicants are highly committed and have a greater understanding of the need for this kind of care, and are putting themselves in positions where they can get the best training. So this is one of the attractive aspects of our residency training program, and it will definitely be harder to attract the top candidates if we are not offering top quality training in abortion care.
Interesting. How much of it is part of the residency, abortion training?
Time-wise, it's a relatively small amount, mm-hmm. but it's a critical aspect of care that can be taught in a finite amount of time and has tremendous impact. And this is not just the kind of training that's important, you know, for people who are going to go on to be experts in complex family planning, but it's also super important for, you know, people who are going into other specialties. So for example, for people who are going to be specialized in infertility, you know, management of non-viable pregnancies is a critical component of that kind of care. And this is the best platform in which to learn that kind of care. And then if you're going into maternal fetal medicine, the subspecialization that deals with high-risk pregnancies, in order to do the best job there, you are going to be dealing with pregnant people who have complex medical issues and, you know, have pregnancies with fetal anomalies. And in order to best care for those people, you also need to learn the skills of abortion provision.
So what happens then if nearly half of all OBGYN residency programs in the U.S. are in states that are likely to ban abortions if Roe falls?
That's a great question. And, you know, it's a multifactorial, complicated answer. You know, one of the main changes that we are seeing and will continue to see in abortion care is, you know, the transition toward more people doing medication abortion. So people, you know, will figure out ways to get access to the medications through a variety of mechanisms. And it works very, very well the vast majority of the time, but it's not perfect. People will come in for care as needed around that. And that's one way to provide, you know, this kind of training, and additional clinics that end up in border locations is another, not to mention simulation and practice in simulated settings. You know, there's a variety of things that can and will be done.
All right. Dr. David Turok, he is an OBGYN in Salt Lake City, one of the few abortion providers in Utah, and he also trains OBGYN residents. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, how ICE created a massive surveillance system that flouts federal and state laws to scoop up data on most adults living in the United States. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has spent billions of dollars since 2008 to build a massive surveillance network, one that can spy not just on immigrants, but on American citizens, too. They've scooped up data from DMVs and public utilities to be able to secretly surveil 3 out of 4 adults in the United States. That's according to a new report from Georgetown University's Law Center on Privacy and Technology. Researchers found that even in states like California, which have laws forbidding state agencies like the DMV from cooperating with ICE, ICE was able to get around those laws. Allison McDonald is one of the co-authors of the report. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, this is a 2-year investigation. How did you get this data, this information?
Yeah, we took a sort of multi-pronged approach. We wanted to know what states knew about what ICE was doing, as well as where they were getting their data. So we sent hundreds of Freedom of Information requests to both states and utility providers. We looked at over a decade's worth of procurement documents, basically where is ICE spending its money, and then did a massive legal review of the different privacy laws that are meant to protect the data to see where they were falling short.
Okay, and so were you surprised by what you found?
I mean, we obviously started the report expecting to find things that were worth reporting, but yeah, the scope of the access that ICE has is absolutely stunning. Nearly 3 in 4 U.S. residents have their data shared with ICE through their utility companies. Almost a third of all U.S. drivers have had their faces scanned by face recognition technology on behalf of ICE. The absolute, like, astounding access that ICE has had to U.S. residents' data is horrific.
So we know that they are concerned with immigration and undocumented immigrants. Why are they scooping up data from American citizens?
What they're doing is building a dragnet surveillance infrastructure. It's not targeted. They're just taking data that they have access to. They've been able to do this largely because their activities have been overlooked and unchecked. There's been little to no federal oversight on any of their activities. And I would also say that data brokers are playing a bigger and bigger role in why this is happening, because if data brokers are collecting the data and have it available to sell, ICE is going to buy it.
Okay, so tell us exactly how they go about getting this data and what data they have exactly. Like, do they know, for example, my driver's license number, where I live, and how much I pay in my utilities? Like, what kind of data are they gathering, and how are they able to get it? Because here in California, we have laws protecting us against this.
Yeah, a lot of the report focuses on how ICE has so many pathways to get at this data that it's really difficult for state lawmakers in particular to effectively cut access. Our report focuses largely on data with DMVs and data through utility companies. So with a DMV, you have your photo, you have your home address, all your sort of biographic data. ICE has access to that in different states through different pathways. In some cases, they have direct access to the database that the DMV is running themselves. They might be able to get it through third-party databases like that are designed for law enforcement. Sometimes they even just email people they know at the DMV and ask them to run a face recognition search on their behalf.
Is that legal?
It's largely unregulated. In many cases, if one of these pathways is cut off, they'll be able to use a different. Yeah.
So I understand the California DMV sells information to LexisNexis. And as a news professional, I've used LexisNexis just to research articles, news stories, and the like. How is LexisNexis getting DMV data, and what's it doing with it? And why would the California DMV sell our info to LexisNexis?
Yeah, so California is one of the states that, as you say, the DMV sells its driver data to LexisNexis. Just a year ago, in March 2021, ICE contracted with LexisNexis to have access to their data. It's a larger set than just DMV data, but a data set that they run that has a lot of biographical data. This is also the type of database that ICE had been using to get access to addresses from utility companies, although that had been with their previous contractor with Thomson Reuters. I can't tell you exactly why your state sells your data to LexisNexis, but once it's in a third-party database, they can sell it to other organizations with very little oversight.
And that's, I guess, legal then. They could do that through a third party.
Right, yes. In California in particular, I know Governor Newsom passed a law that was meant to restrict the sharing of utility data with ICE. This prevented utility companies from selling data. The thing is that what we found in terms of how ICE was getting access to people's home addresses through their utility data, the utility companies weren't selling the data, they were sharing it for the purposes of credit reporting. The credit reporting trade organization that was collecting it was then able to turn around and share it with Equifax, who got to share it, to sell it to Thomson Reuters, who sold it to ICE. Oh, and when you have a chain like that, there's so little oversight, and in many cases, even maybe most cases, the utility companies didn't know that that's, where their data was ending up.
So I imagine that this information has then been used by ICE to conduct raids, immigration raids.
We have some numbers on the number of, for example, we have data from Washington State on the number of requests that have been sent to their face recognition service, and it's tens of thousands. So some of these are going to be civil, some of them are going to be criminal. It doesn't really matter, but ultimately ICE is collecting this data in order to do internal immigration enforcement, yeah.
So if the federal government, if DHS, if Secretary Mayorkas wanted to put a stop to this, could he?
Yeah, I think the biggest barrier is that there has been very little federal oversight into how ICE is spending their data and then how they're spending their money on these data sets and then using them. There is definitely space for Congress to take aggressive action to conduct this oversight. How effective that is depends a lot on how well DHS is going to cooperate. And until now, they've been very reluctant to participate in these kinds of oversight actions. That would be like the best first step. We need better understanding of how this is happening. This took us 2 years to uncover. There's so much more, I think, that we would find out if there was a way for us to get more direct answers from ICE.
Allison McDonald, research fellow at the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Apple is killing the iPod. It was unveiled in 2001 as a way to rescue the flagging company.
In this whole new digital music revolution, there is no market leader. And we think not only can we find the recipe, but we think the Apple brand is going to be fantastic.
That's Steve Jobs there. An appreciation of the iPod next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Say bye-bye to the iPod. Apple is pulling the plug some 20 years or so after it was first introduced. And if you rushed out to buy one when it first came out in 2001, you may have filled it with these bangers of the moment. This is how you remind me. Miss Jackson. Well, joining us to talk about the end of the iPod era is Trip Mickle. He covers Apple for the New York Times, and he's author of the new book, After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul. Hi, Trip.
Hi.
Well, I guess we know the why here, and that is iPhone. But still, what do you make of this decision to actually pull the plug officially?
Well, it's a great chance for us to be a bit nostalgic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And think about how fun this device was for those of us who, seen the Walkman era, and then after that, kind of the CDs be portable, and they were just clumsy and in the way, and how refreshing it was to not only have a portable device again that you could carry, but one that could hold 1,000 songs and pretty much eventually hold your entire music catalog.
Right. So, yeah, I remember, yeah, you'd walk around with your backpack full of CDs or cassettes jangling around. That wasn't very convenient. So how did this come about? Like, who came up with this idea?
It's so funny. And talking with some of the people who led the effort yesterday, they were humored by the fact that their ambitions were so modest. At the time, the Macintosh computer, which was really the only thing that Apple sold, and this was a company coming out of a flirtation with bankruptcy, they were looking for a way to get more people to buy Macintosh computers. I mean, that's why they said, let's create a music player. They recognized there were some early portable music players in the market that were playing digital music. Ripping CDs and burning CDs was becoming popular on computers. People were beginning to build their own playlists. Napster was coming onto the scene. Apple looked at all of this and said, okay, music is a huge market. If we can tap into that, then we can sell more computers.
Oh, wow. So that's interesting. They saw it as a way to jumpstart the computer industry, because I guess Microsoft was the dominant force there.
Right. At the time, Microsoft had more than 90% share of the market through PC computers and its Windows operating system. And Apple wanted to chip away at that. And so Steve Jobs launches this effort, and it partly took flight because of some good fortune. One of the leading engineers, John Rubinstein, was in Japan, and he happened to be meeting with Toshiba, and they had a new hard drive disk that was about 2 inches in size and could hold more songs than anything else in the market. And he said, let's buy it all. And so they bought out the market and then developed this product that had a unique blend that only Apple, you know, could bring to a product. It was sophisticated in its design. I don't know if anybody remembers, but that first one had a heavy stainless steel backing to it, and then the white AirBuds, which were a differentiator from the black AirBuds that everyone had carried for the Walkman. And that heft of the stainless steel was a deliberate design choice because they wanted people to know that the songs that they were carrying, the 1,000 songs, were made by artists and deserved to be treated with weight and respect. And then on top of that, they had the iTunes software, which simplified the way that people transferred their music from the computer onto the device and copied CDs and everything else. And that combination of software and design and then eventually sophisticated commercials were what allowed the product to take flight.
Oh, yeah, those commercials. So you had the black silhouettes with the white iPods, the headphones, rather. And those are really incredible. I can see them right now in my mind's eye, even though how old are they?
Oh God. I mean, those launched in the mid 2000s and they were everywhere. I mean, you couldn't walk through a subway station without passing a poster of a dancing black silhouette holding, against a bright green or bright pink background.
Right. So then the iPod that got smaller, it lost that heft that you were talking about earlier and eventually ended up like in a nano size.
right. There's some fascinating business lessons that came out of the product's development. Steve Jobs did something that was very cavalier and downright like bordered on lunacy at the time. He took Apple's best-selling product ever, which was the iPod Nano and probably the best-selling consumer electronics of that year, and decided they were going to eliminate it and replace it. Or this was the Mini, and they were going to replace it with the Nano. Mm. And to do that, they had to shut down production of the Mini about 6 months before they could launch the Nano. So they embarked on this effort not knowing what would happen. And lo and behold, when they released the Nano, it was twice as popular, and they sold 40 million units of iPods that year, which was double what they sold the year before.
Well, I will wager that maybe a small portion of that is because people just left them in their pants pockets and they went through the laundry.
It's possible. It's possible. But I mean, I can recall leaving mine in a pant pocket, going through the laundry and coming out, and it was just fine.
Yeah, so that's true. Okay, yeah. So then it makes way for the where we are today with the phone. So how did the iPod pave the way for the iPhone, which debuted back in 2007?
Well, there's a common thought in Silicon Valley that if you don't innovate, someone else will come along and innovate you out of business. And Steve Jobs recognized, with everybody holding an iPod in one hand and a mobile phone in the other, that eventually those two products were going to converge. And so around 2005, he put a team to work on developing the iPhone because he wanted to replace the iPod himself before someone else did so. And they introduced the iPhone in 2007, and the rest is history, right? I mean, that product has become indispensable, and it's the reason they can come out as they did yesterday, two decades after the iPod was introduced, and say the iPod is no more.
Huh. So do you think we'll be having a conversation anytime soon, talking nostalgically about the iPhone?
Oh, goodness. We are, it's a great question. I mean, we're pushing towards 15 years of that product, which is wild. And yet it defies all kind of rational behavior for a consumer electronics product, in that usually after about 10 years, let's say if you go back and look at TVs, for example, after about 10 years, the pricing on those products typically go down. At 10 years, Apple did the opposite. They increased the cost of the iPhone, and they are selling even more of them. So until another product comes along that is more valuable and does all the things that the iPhone does, then it will reign supreme.
Trip Mickle covers Apple for The New York Times. He's author of the new book, After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul. Trip, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So 1, 2, 3, take my hand and come with me because you look so fine that I really want to make you mine.
Coming up, Julia Morgan was California's first licensed female architect. She designed Hearst Castle and hundreds of other buildings. Julia Morgan next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Now, this huge mansion has 115 rooms, including 38 bedrooms. And along with its gardens and fountains and guest houses is a true California treasure.
That's Huell Hauser, of course, exploring Hearst Castle for an episode of his classic public television show, California's Gold. You can again tour that palatial estate, which is a state park. It reopens today after being closed for 2 years because of COVID and because of damage to the main road from rainstorms last year. Well, when Huell Hauser toured Hearst Castle back in 2009, his guide was Victoria Kastner. She was the castle's official historian for more than 3 decades. And when she first visited, she was surprised to find that California's most famous estate was designed by a woman whom most people had never heard of, architect Julia Morgan. Victoria Kastner set out to find out who she was through interviews, letters, and Morgan's recently discovered personal diaries. The result is a new book. It's called Julia Morgan, an intimate biography of the trailblazing architect. And Victoria Kastner, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you.
Well, how did Julia Morgan become an architect at a time in the early 20th century when women didn't do such things? There weren't many female architects, and most women didn't work outside the home.
It was quite remarkable, and especially when we consider that the female architects before her, and as you say, there were some, were either married to an architect and then inherited the firm or started in an office, like Marion Mahoney Griffin was in Frank Lloyd Wright's office and became effectively an apprentice. She was an architect with the best qualifications imaginable by going to Paris's School of Fine Arts, the École des Beaux-Arts, and being the first woman to graduate from it in 1648, it was founded, and she graduated in 1902. So she truly was a driven person and one of America's great architects.
How did she decide to become an architect? Where did that come from? And she grew up in Oakland, right?
She grew up in Oakland when it really was the elegant suburb of San Francisco. Better weather, bigger lots, nicer houses. She was born in 1872, 150 years ago this year. And she went to Oakland High School and was good in science. And she decided to major in architecture, perhaps because her second cousin married a famous New York architect named Pierre Lebrun. And so she learned about architecture early. There wasn't even an architecture department at Cal Berkeley when she decided this, but when Julia enrolled in 1890, she enrolled as a civil engineering major. And she did her undergraduate work in civil engineering before she went to Paris to study.
Oh my gosh. So she was probably one of the few, if the only woman in civil engineering at Berkeley at that time.
She was the only woman in civil engineering who ever used it professionally. A couple of women had taken the course, but no one else made a career out of it except for Julia Morgan.
So she studies at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris and gets her degree. And she's 30 years old and unmarried. And at that point in our history, that's considered really old to be unmarried at 30. Did she turn down marriage proposals or was she never interested?
There were really two longstanding myths about Julia Morgan, and one involved this issue of her romantic relationships. You're absolutely right. By the time, at the turn of the century, a woman reached 30, she really was at, past marriageable material. But I don't think it was an issue, and I also don't think that she had same-sex relationships. One of the things I've done to research this book was transcribe literally 800,000 words of her correspondence and diaries with my research assistant, Ruth Latson. And the other myth about Julia Morgan is that She burned all her papers, so that certainly isn't true. But in looking at all 800,000 of those words and interviews, dozens of interviews with employees, fans, family, there's no indication of romantic relationships with anyone. I think back then in the first third of the 20th century, if you were a career woman, it took all your time. And especially that was the case in Julia Morgan's life, because she also was involved with a lot of family care. She had family members with acute illnesses who really preoccupied her spare time as well.
Okay, so how did she meet her most famous client, William Randolph Hearst?
She met William Randolph Hearst through his mother. And I think that that was the glue that stuck these two very superficially different people together, small, modest, quiet Julia Morgan and large and, you know, politically active William Randolph Hearst. His mother was Phoebe Apperson Hearst, and she was the greatest philanthropist that California has ever known. And one of the things she did was fund the redesign of the University of California campus, as well as start the Save the Redwoods League and restore the missions and all manner of California philanthropies. So she introduced Julia to her son when Julia would have been in her about 32, mm-hmm. and W.R. would have been about 43. And so that was when they first met. And actually, around 1903, they began to work together pretty soon. She worked on a number of projects for him really pretty much throughout her career, and didn't start San Simeon until 1919, when she was 47 and he was 56.
How did she convince him that she was the architect to build this dream estate of his?
It is a remarkable collaboration. It would be remarkable today. But when we consider that when she started San Simeon in 1919, she could not vote in a presidential election. And it was job number 503 of Julia Morgan's 700 buildings. It shows how astonishingly ahead of her time she truly was. And the interesting thing about W.R., though he was a kind of political firebrand in his newspapers, he was a fascinating art collector who really loved architecture. And maybe because he had such a strong mother, he also had women at the highest positions in most of his businesses. His top reporters were women, his best screenwriters were women. And so he didn't have issues with Julia Morgan's authority. He would say, "I make a lot of suggestions, and if they don't work out right, please ignore them." And we know that because just the two of them exchanged 2,462 letters and telegrams. So we have an unbelievable archive documenting their collaborations at San Simeon. Now, what Miss Morgan would do, and that was what he called her, you know, in those days it was Mr. Hearst, Miss Morgan. People didn't refer to one another by their first names unless they were really family members. But anyway, what she would do, according to one of these female top reporters, Adela Rogers St. Johns, who worked for Hearst for many years, and she said, "Miss Morgan could say nothing in more ways than my great aunt Betsy Bogart." So she would have the pregnant pause, or steer him, or ask a clarifying question if one of his ideas was a little off kilter, because, you know, she knew that what he wanted was for it to be the best. But the wonderful thing about them was how each of them, in this extraordinary collaboration, 28 years of building San Simeon, brought out the best in each other. He deferred to her and respected and admired her. And she was able to build in a palatial scale that very few architects in the 20th century have ever, been able to duplicate by having a client like William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah. So just give us a scale of this place. And it took, 28 years to build? It took a long time. It kept getting bigger and bigger.
Because we know this, it was overheard. He walked into her office. What happened was his mother, Phoebe, died in 1919. California came to a halt, flags at half mast. She was that much of a philanthropist. But that meant that at 56, William Randolph Hearst suddenly had a fortune that he'd kind of been waiting for a long time. He was only 2 years old when his father, George, who was a miner, gold, silver, and copper miner, first bought land at San Simeon. So literally, William Randolph Hearst had been going to San Simeon his entire life. So he'd obviously been itching to build there. And in 1919, late one evening, he walked into Julia Morgan's office, and an engineer overheard him say, "I'm getting a little old for tents. I'm tired of camping on the hill at San Simeon, Miss Morgan. I'm thinking of building something." And the first thing he described was going to be one bungalow, 6 months easy. You know, and as you say, it went on for 28 years. And as for its size, you're right, it's not finished. It's vast. The top of the hill, the enclosed amount of square footage is 110,000 square feet. That's comprised in five buildings, a large main building, which people now call the castle. It looks like a twin-towered cathedral. That has 160 rooms. And then three cottages, each given names for their views of the sun and the setting sun and the mountains and the ocean. And then there's an indoor swimming pool as well. So that's just all the buildings with the roof on them is 110,000 square feet at the top of the hill, about 100 acres of landscaped gardens, two swimming pools. And then at the bottom of the hill, all of the ranch facilities and estate village where Hearst Ranch employees still live today, warehouses, duck ponds, cowboy bunkhouses. It's absolutely immense, and it's all on 85,000 acres of ranch land. Oh, so the part that's open to the public and will, after a two-year hiatus, be available for touring is just the top of the hill, about 120 acres altogether.
Right. He wanted a zoo, or he had a zoo with lots of exotic animals, lions and zebras and llamas.
He did have a zoo. He did. He loved animals. And so Julia Morgan's getting letters that say things like telegrams. Dear Miss Morgan, we need Icelandic moss for the reindeer to eat.
Gosh. Wow. All right. So I guess no fantasy was considered too ridiculous. It's interesting when you contrast their styles, as you just did. She's sort of this quiet, reserved, small woman who would just eat saltines. People didn't really see her eat that much. And here he is, this grandiose, millionaire. And yet they had this friendship for decades. What was her style, her architectural style? Did she have a singular vision, or did she mold it to fit her clients' tastes?
It was true that when I first arrived at San Simeon to take a tour before I started working there in the 1980s, I was told, you know, a woman built this, but we don't know anything about her. And then as she did become discovered, because she did design 700 buildings, and by the 80s and 90s, people were appreciating the vast number of her jobs. But people said back then, well, you know, she's really just a client's architect. She doesn't have a distinctive style. And so they really put her in a kind of second tier position among architects of America. It wasn't until the 1990s when actually it was architects who started saying, wait a minute, why is it a bad thing if you design what the client actually wants you to build? You know, if you hired Frank Lloyd Wright, who was her exact contemporary, by the way, but had with way too many, decided opinions to have made it probably more than a week working for William Randolph Hearst. They never did collaborate. But anyway, you got the building that he thought you should have. Mm-hmm. If you hired Julia Morgan, she gave you the building you wanted. And that could mean anything. It could mean San Simeon if she's working for him. There was a client in the Bay Area who didn't like right angles. And she designed a house for him and his wife that didn't have right angles in it. There was a client in Northern California who got cold in the morning and didn't like to get out of bed to turn on the heat. So she designed a contraption that worked underneath the covers so he could stay in bed and get the room warm before he had to get out of it.
Wow, she was so ingenious.
So she honored the client she worked for. And it was actually, I think, in my opinion, belated. But in 2014, the American Institute of Architects decided to award her their highest honor, the gold medal. And in 100 years, she was the very first woman they ever gave that distinguished award to, and still the only single woman who has received it. She was given it posthumously in 2014. And it was because she cared so much about the client, and she understood what architecture means. It's safety, shelter, comfort, familiarity. It's so much more for all of us than merely four walls and a roof.
Right.
And so she really believed that whoever you were, you should be exalted by the surroundings. And so she honored everyone with her buildings.
Well, the other thing is, with her knowledge and ability with civil engineering, she was able to build buildings that withstood earthquakes, most notably the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco.
She did. And when San Simeon had its own trial, which it did in 2005, when the San Simeon earthquake, which was 6.5 on the Richter scale and was just, the epicenter was just 10 miles out to sea at San Simeon, a couple of statues tumbled off. They had to repoint the bricks in one fireplace and repair a couple cracks in one of the swimming pools, and that was it. And she had such an understanding of the technology of building and the processes of engineering that her buildings, well, it's really true that of those 700, many hundreds still survive, and they are in beautiful shape, and they haven't changed. most of them, because they so beautifully met the needs of their clients that they've seldom been remodeled. Mm.
Well, we can catch up and learn more about Julia Morgan by reading your book. So thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
Victoria Kastner, her book is called Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect. Well, it is just about the end of the show. However, I'm just going to take a minute to ask you to become a member of KCRW. This is our spring pledge drive, so it's the time of year when we ask for your support, and we celebrate you. We celebrate our members with some special incentives, and here's one you might be interested in. It is your chance to win a brand new iPhone. Elevate your screen time with the latest Apple device. We know it's tough for a lot of folks out there these days, really tough days in the world, but it's tough for us too. And to be frank with you, we are a little behind our goals when it comes to fundraising. So we need you to step up right now. So dig deep and give. Do it by tomorrow night, and you'll be automatically entered to win the latest iPhone. So do it now. 800-600-5279, KCRW.com/join. Become a member today. Renew your membership. Increase your membership if you can. We do rely on you. We need you very, very much these days. And maybe you could be the winner of the new iPhone. All right. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.